Today, the only three ways to grow any business. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Notice Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. It's my pleasure today to bring you Jay Abraham. Hi, Jay.
Hello, Martin. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks very much for spending some time on our channel. You are a marketing guru. You've been in the industry for 40 years. You've advised thousands and thousands of corporations and businesses around marketing and marketing strategy. And what you have is a unique perspective based on just so many engagements, and there are some wonderful lessons to be learned.
Thank you. It's been a long ride, but what I've tried to do, Martin, is identify universal truths that had applicability and leverageability to almost any type, size, scope of business that applied it. So it's a pretty interesting career, and it's more universal truths, principles that anybody can apply.
Right. And I think that's very interesting because, of course, people often get down in the weeds and think about, you know, individual campaigns. But we're talking strategic, aren't you?
Yes. I mean, most everything I try to figure out is the big problem is most people are very tactical, and smaller businesses particularly. But a tactic, Martin, should never be used unless it advances and enhances the major strategy. And most companies don't even have a strategy. Bigger ones do. But when it comes to marketing, marketing needs to be really a driver of strategy. It shouldn't be just a bunch of random episodic sort of mud on the wall experiments. And that's unfortunately what a lot of smaller businesses do.
Right. And there's a difference between a marketing strategy and a marketing execution and delivery, right? And I think a lot of people think that the execution and delivery is marketing, but that's not really it, is it?
No, it is. I mean, marketing is pretty interesting. It's a little bit amorphous to try to really identify, just like strategy. There's 9 million definitions, and it's sort of who you're talking to. But I think that really marketing is about, first of all, identifying a felt need, educating that segment of a market to the problem or opportunity they're after, helping them see the impact, either negative impact, suboptimal impact, and the impact of resolving it, and then having them see that resolution is very realistically possible from whatever product service you provide, and then having them be compelled enough to want that solution immediately, quickly, and wanting it predominantly and presumably from you. That's sort of how I try to describe it. It may not be an accurate one, but I think that's a good context or reference.
Right. And to what extent is marketing necessary to understand the customers you're targeting?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I understand the question correctly. Many years ago, the famous management guru, Peter Drucker, said that marketing and innovation produce profits. Everything else is an expense. I would add strategy to it, marketing strategy and innovation. But marketing is really the means by which you connect who you are, what you are, why you are, and why what you are is valuable to somebody that has the need. Without it, it's sort of you're the accidental beneficiary. I mean, most people don't really. They're not very adroit. They're not very able and masterful at making that connection. And the more proficient, the more astute you are at making it, you know, the more asymmetric the yield that business produces for you, I think.
Right. So you mentioned need, right? And that means understanding your target market, understanding what your customer really needs or think they might need, or you can influence that need, and then meeting the need. So marketing has to also connect with the execution delivery part of the business too, doesn't it?
It does. And just a comment, I don't want to be rogue on you. I think a really interesting thread in this identification of need is a definition of what value means to the other side, because there's such a frequent disconnect that the entrepreneur, the business owner, the professional thinks that what their definition of value is in alignment with the target, and it's very rarely the same.
Right. And that's very interesting, because quite often, in my experience at least, some companies think they know what the value that they're offering is, but it's not necessarily matching with what the need and the value from the consumer or the customer end is. So there's a big mismatch.
Yeah, it's very interesting. When I used to do seminars, and I did a lot of them years ago in Australia as well, I would do exercises to try to show that what you think value is very different. We would take any kind of a construct, a reference to anything, and then we'd randomly go around the room and try to see what people's definition. And they're so different. And if I presuppose that I know what your really highest and most whatever I call it, impactful, decision-making factor is, I could be so off the mark. And that's what happens most often. I mean, getting clarity on what your market values, what's important, what's not, what they want, what they don't want, and why. When you get that clarity, it is a power source that gives you enormous growth potential.
And I guess the question then is, well, so what process or processes should companies go through to be able to understand what that real need is?
I have, and it's only in the last few years I can give you the answer I'm giving now. The previous answer would have been a lot of research, a lot of analysis, all things like that. I have a shortcut which has been pretty infallible for almost everyone I have shared it with. And if you'd like, I'll share it with your audience as well. I call it the Amazon.com School of, and you can fill in the blank, Martin. It can be the School of Marketing, School of Advertising, the School of Market Research, the School of Value Creation. And what it is in a nutshell, it's sort of cool, and I stumbled across it, but it's really powerful. So if you take whatever category your business or product or service or company or practice is involved in, and then you go to Amazon or whoever bookseller that's still around, and you look at as many book categories that directly or indirectly relate to that, and you go back 2 or 3 years and you look at the top 25 books in those categories for those 3 years, and you look at titles, first of all, and subtitles. Most books, tragically, Martin, they sell because of the promise more than the content. So the promise has nailed it. So if you see what's the title and the subtitle, then you go to the chapter titles, because if it's a high or a bestseller, it probably nailed the same resonance with the market need on the chapter titles. And then this is the real key. Then you go to the reviews. And Amazon used to be, I have to check, used to be 0 to 5. Is it still the same in Australia?
Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
So a 0 is terrible, a 5 is great. People don't realize this. When somebody is passionate, positively passionate, negatively passionate, their subconscious has a remarkable ability to override conscious. And the way they express themselves is with a magnificent clarity, dimensionality, animated visualization. If you think about it, other than the vulgarity, cut that out. When they're angry, when they're happy, they say things in ways that are so crystal clear and powerful. You go, whoa. And so what you do is you go to these categories and you strip out you scrape two different things, all the negatives, all the positive. Then you do it for all the discussion groups on the topic. Then you can even go to your competitors or other people anywhere in the world doing it. Now you've got two massive research data files. You've got the most negative that people don't want. You got the most positive, what they want and usually why. Now you consolidate, and you consolidate the similarities, but you do it in descending order of frequency. So the most frequent ones that you consolidate is here and there, and you go all down. Well, now you can play to your audience perfectly, because you know on average what they want, why, what they don't want, why. You don't even, you have the ability to express that yours does this, it doesn't do this, You have the ability to express, you know they don't want this. It's a masterful and infallible form of whatever you wanted. Research, value, kneeling value creation, value assessment, projection, marketing, selling, website creation. It's pretty cool. And it's never failed any client I've ever done it for.
That's really fascinating, and it's charms is something I talk about a lot, which is the idea of customer centricity. So you build your business from your customers rather than what you may have as a sort of the product you're trying to push out there, right? Because if you're pushing out, then you're not necessarily meshing very well with precisely where the fit is in the mind of the customer.
Yeah. No, I mean, I got trained in the world of testing and variability, and it is sort of been taken to an art form with the likes of Facebook algorithms. But with regard to hypothesis, whenever you can pre-validate something, it's always wiser to do that before you invest an enormous amount of opportunity cost, capital, resources, time, and expectation in a hypothesis that may be erroneous.
Mm. Absolutely. And I guess the other question I've got is it a continuous process? I mean, you know, because I guess things change. So it's not, you can't just do it and then sort of put it on the shelf, can you?
No, there's two different implications to it. One is you kind of constantly validate and verify that your current reality is still it. And then there's another one, and it's another version, pardon my voice, from Drucker. Either you are constantly committed to make your current business and products and services and actions obsolete, or you can rest assured your competitors are committed to do it to you and for you.
Yes. So you almost have to try to destroy your own business, because if you don't destroy it, somebody else is going to.
Yeah. And I mean, it used to be, I got started long ago, you had a lot more runway of benefiting from hitting a winning combination, whether it's proposition, media, ad, value proposition, product. But today, Jesus, there's two different concepts. One is there's too much easy access competition. And number two, there's so many, the need that your product or service fills may be singular, but the alternative ways to fill it are now so multitudinous, and there's new things coming up all the time. I used to use an analogy that if you're in the business of selling a supplement for weight loss, you're competing with every other supplement, you're competing with portion control food, you're competing with personal trainers, online trainers, equipment like Peloton, books, videos. You're also competing with inertia and procrastination and equivocation. If you're not aware of all those competitions, you can't possibly, you know, optimize your success.
Absolutely. Now, there were the three points, which I think are just worth underscoring again. It's about the number of clients. It's about the average transactions and the frequency of those transactions, right? They're the three fundamentals.
Yeah. I mean, I used to get questions when I started doing seminars, and they'd say, well, there must be a million ways to grow a business. And I would say, actually, there's only three primary and three advanced. And then there's a million, you know, million tactics within there. And they really are. As you said it, first is you want to increase the number of buyers, clients, patients. And correspondingly, you might want to increase the number of prospects that convert over. Second, you want to increase the size of the transaction and thus the profitability of it. Third, you want to increase the frequency or the utility of purchase. Frequency is obvious. So if you have nothing else to do, the utility, as many more ways as you can monetize it. And if we have a model, I didn't really think to make available to you, but there's a very simple graphic. We take a hypothetical 1,000 buyer company with each buyer spending $100 two times a year, and we walk people through 1,000 buyers buying $100 twice a year. They spend $200,000. That's the revenue of the business. we show that if you, and I work on the geometry of the business, Martin, I learned long ago that that's where the greatest opportunity and the greatest explosive and safe growth comes. It's easier to grow geometrically on the profit side, certainly, than the top line. But if you only grew those three categories in my little quick mental example, 10%, and 1,000 buyers became 1,100, and $100 unit of purchase became 110, and the two purchases a year became 2.2, you would think it, that you've increased your business 10%, but you haven't. It's 33 1/3. If you went a lot further, if you did double all those, it would be 800%. And it's not just 800%, because at certain increases, the cost of supporting or fulfilling is very, very modest. So additional incremental sales can be 2 or 3 times more profitable. I apologize for that. They never learned how to get rid of it on my computer. But yeah, I learned that. There are three other ways, and I'll share those because they're pretty cool too. But you got to do the ones that I suggested and you asked me about first. The more advanced way is every year penetrate one new market or niche. Every year introduce one new product or service. And that goes three ways. It can be a product, an easier entry product, something less difficult for someone to start a buying relationship. So the sooner they do the first purchase, the sooner they'll do the second and third. It can be something you can add to the average purchase, so you get the unit of sale and the profit up. It can be something more expensive that you add towards the end once you've gotten a more seasoned purchasing relationship. And the last is that you acquire one new business, not a brand new one, but one business every year. It can be a competitor. It can be complementary, something people buy before, during, after, even instead, and you buy it on an earnout where you don't put any money down. It just by consolidating it, economies of scale, duplicated functions, you can pay a very generous either variable on profit or just an agreed upon amount out of profits. And if you do that every year, your business just keeps compounding and compounding. The two things, the three ways to grow a business and the three advanced ways. And they're very logical when you put a pencil to it and look at it.
And the point, I guess, that I take from that is you've got to think of a business as an organic entity that's going to continue to grow and develop, or it will atrophy.
Perfect example. I mean, the adage of you grow or die is so, there's a lot of phrases that seem trite, but you grow or die as a value creator, you grow or die as an entity, you grow or die with your knowledge base, you grow or die with the markets. Yeah. And if it doesn't intimidate you, it empowers you. So it's all a function of paradigm.
And to be honest, do you think that even smaller businesses can apply some of these principles, or is it just, you know, beyond them? What do you think?
No, as I said earlier, my body of work, my career has been either dedicated or defined, however you want to choose it, by creating universal truths and principles that can be applied anywhere. You know, larger companies are going to get, you know, more yield, but There's no business, even a startup, even a pre-startup, those two categories should be incorporated into their whole master strategy.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because I reflect on, you know, my own business here, and I'm actually intrinsically doing what you've outlined, you know, continuing to grow and develop, not being willing to stand still, extending, adding other things in. It's always sort of being quite a little scary because you're on the edge and you're always thinking about the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. But I think that's what you got to do.
Yeah. I mean, if you realize this, that everything has a cycle, and that there's nothing more exciting than growth. I mean, really, there isn't. It's intimidating only until you gain proficiency at the process. The process of looking at what's emerging trends, looking at buying attitudes of the market, looking at vehicles for reaching them. But if you're opportunistic opportunity focus, then your radar is always looking at how can I grow every facet of the business, product, service, value creation, access to market, new additional product services. I mean, it's actually exciting. And the biggest thing most people don't realize is you don't have to do it alone. If you identify product service categories, but your business doesn't seem able to grow, develop it, you can always partner with somebody that has it. And when you realize that you have unlimited resources, but most smaller businesses, Martin, they would tell you they are resource impaired. They can't afford marketing or technology or a sales force or offices in other places or research and development. Or, and that's BS. There's always somebody that possesses that if you can figure out how to align their interest with yours, being giving them a share of the revenue, giving them something that occurs that they want, you can get resources galore and always pay for them out of results.
Mm. And I want to come back to digital, because it seems to me that the digital world that we're now in, you know, facilitates and enables that virtual connectivity and that ability to partner much more easily than previously.
Well, absolutely. There are people, you can reach people all over the world. You can access talent pools all over the world. You can get all kinds of other people to do all kinds of things for you and tie their, whether it's research, development, creating things. There's a book that just came out and it's hilarious. It's not funny, but it's hilarious. The book title is Who, Not How. And the concept of the book is you don't want to figure out how to do something. You want to figure who can do it for you. And the author, who's a very prominent strategic coach, had other people write it for him. He didn't even touch it. It's a great book. But he didn't tell you that till the last couple of pages. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it's the hardest thing to grapple with is the correct mindset, Martin. It's all about, I mean, it's about, you know, how it's your worldview, I think. And if you can basically flip your worldview to opportunity-based, not opportunistic, opportunity-based. And if you can understand strategy over tactic, if you can understand infinite and unlimited resources, and you can understand that whatever you need to acquire, it's available, and that you've always had available the power to monumentally multiply the performance of your business, usually with no extra investment or risk. It's just doing things differently. It's very exhilarating and liberating.
Well, it's fascinating. I'm a philosopher by training, and I talk a lot about what I call the worldview that you actually occupy, right? And many people have an implicit worldview, which actually gets in the way of releasing their potential. But as you say, if you can transform your worldview and think about it differently, then suddenly new doors open.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I mean, one of my heroes and somebody who has influenced my conduct is Socrates. Mm. I believe everybody needs to be able to master Socratic interview. And I also believe while traveling broadens the mind, traveling from industry to industry, from knowledge base to knowledge base broadens the mindset. And if you want to, I mean, the game you're playing in business, whether you acknowledge it or not, is how do I gain absolute advantage in every activity I do? Well, you don't gain it by being very restrictive in your paradigm. You're not asking this, but I'll give you a couple of precepts. I believe there's a fallacy even in the concept of best practices, because very often best practices as its practice tend to be the best practices in one or two related industries. They have nothing to do. Those are incremental. They're not geometric. They're not, I mean, if you look at where great breakthroughs come from, Martin, almost always from outside of an industry. I used to do a whole session, and if you'll let me, I'll go a little old school on it because I can't really easily access new ones. But fiber optics, which redefined telecommunication, was not created for telecommunication. It was aerospace. Federal Express borrowed what the U.S. was using called the hub and spoke check clearing process that our Federal Reserve Bank used to make sure checks didn't bounce and get them the next day cleared by 10 o'clock. Rogaine came from pimples, Viagra from heart. I don't have my pen, ballpoint pen or roll-on deodorant, one from the other. But your greatest strength comes from traveling outside your industry.
Absolutely. And very often people get locked into their own narrow vertical. I mean, I see this in the financial services industry in particular, where I spend a lot of my time. People never look beyond, right? And therefore they miss the opportunity.
Yeah, no. And I think that it's intimidating. We used to do big seminars, and my whole strength comes from the spectacle of possibility that I've been able to experience because I've done 1,000 industries. And we would find people at the seminar. This is before the bookstores ended. I'd go to bookstores and buy 1,000 either out of print nonfiction books or magazines. And I would ask every attendee through my team, you know, what's your hobby? What is your skill set? And let's say you said engineering. I would give you a book on macrame or a book on take cake decorating or whatever was the polar opposite, send you up to your room for 2 hours. If it was a magazine, make you read two articles. If it was a book, two chapters, and then come down and share one distinction that you got from that you saw had direct implication positively to your business. And it was mind blowing. There was never, ever anyone who did the exercise who didn't find some implication, but most people would never look there.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about not looking there, one other question, you know, with the pandemic and everything that's been happening over the last year or so, do you think that's changed the perspective in terms of, you know, the marketing story or is there something we can learn from that, do you think?
Well, I think that there's a couple of answers. I mean, I think there's certain people who are flourishing. A lot of the people who are really, really mastered virtual training did really well. I don't know if they're still doing well, but for a while people were so they still are, you know, locked at home, but they were so out of their normalcy that they were defaulting to something that would engage them. And then certain people were worried about the security of their job or they're out of work, so they did a lot of training courses, whether it be investment, whether it be, you know, training career-wise. I think, you know, many forms of business have had to change. One of my children is a sommelier, and he worked at a 3-star Michelin restaurant, and he isn't working right now because there's not enough carryout business with that kind of model, and they don't sell enough expensive bottles of wine to take home. And so those things change. I think that opportunity to connect more easily has been made very comfortable by the Zooms and the Skypes and all the other platforms. I think that, I mean, when the pandemic, and you know, you're more Sydney, you're not Melbourne, right?
Yeah.
Melbourne Sydney, was yeah. Either was hit harder or took it differently. You see that we're a mess. And it's very tragic, and I don't want to get into, you know, politicizing why. But when it first started, I was doing interviews all over, and I identified 5 windows of opportunity that were enormously apparent that most people weren't hitting on. Number one, in a market like this, when a lot of businesses are struggling, you'll never have had, and it's diminishing, but you still have it, the opportunity to collaborate, to partner, to joint venture like you have today, because everybody wants more revenue and is looking for advantage. Number two, you'll never have as many businesses that are in trouble wanting to be acquired, even on an earnout, because a lot of them are operating at break even. And if you can take them over, integrate them in your business, consolidate functions, you can pay somebody more for a business that's dying than they would ever make trying to hold on to it. There's two kinds of people that are out of work. It may not be as evident there. Here, they tend to be a lot of low skilled, but then there's a number of super skilled. And what people don't realize, Martin, is the super skilled, before they lost their job, they spent years building trust and direct access to key decision makers and influencers in different categories of business or industry. And now they're out of work and most of them don't have any kind of prohibitive contract. You can find them by doing searches on LinkedIn, and you can find, if you can prove the value of your company, product, service, you can get those people to introduce you to all their past contacts in the form of a couple of weeks. And that can take, that can replace a lifetime of trying to get access and just pay them a share. There's tons of salespeople here who've been put out because either their employer consolidated or it just wasn't, they couldn't sell the product as well or at all. And they can do all those other things. And then there's all kinds of rights. There's something I call option trading. You're an investment, but it doesn't mean what investment people think. It means getting control of rights or getting control of of assets. I'll give you a couple of examples. In the United States, many years ago, a friend of mine came to California from the East Coast, and he had no job. He was very good, inherent entrepreneur, and he was looking for an arbitrage play. And he saw the place where we hold the Rose Bowl and where our university, UCLA, plays football is called the Rose Bowl. And it's a facility that's huge, but it's only used a few days every year on the weekends. And most of the time it's empty. It has huge parking. It has huge exhibits area. Pardon me. He realized it would be a perfect vehicle for flea markets. He went to the county of Los Angeles that owned it, negotiated the rights to operate flea markets on the off days, which were most of the days on the weekends. He knew nothing about flea markets, but once he had the agreement, he had a provision he could bring a partner, and he found the largest flea market management company, and he flipped his agreement for $500,000 up front and an override, and he made millions of dollars a year just for seeing the opportunity. There was somebody, and I don't remember the city in Australia, but the person was brilliant. There were laws in the downtown area. I don't remember if it was Perth or it was one of the larger, but not the largest city. And there were laws against having a promotional advertised signage on the outside of office buildings downtown. But the guy realized there were no laws that said you couldn't have signage on the inside outside. So he went and got the rights to all the ground floor offices to do the windows outside, and he tied it all up. And then he went to the big sign company and he flipped the rights for a lot of money. So it's there's a lot of opportunity if you're able to see it and connect it. And the biggest problem with most people is they don't believe it. It's an ideological problem. Very interesting. But most people, I mean, the ideas that I teach have generated, very honestly, tens of billions of dollars for the people that have acted on it. But I stopped doing seminars because I had at the peak 100,000 success stories. Now that sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
It's a fair
but
number.
I had taught the methodologies to millions of people. And I was just heartbroken that this many people thought it they were viable enough or doable enough or applicable to them enough to do anything with it. And I just thought, I don't really want to teach it anymore in public because I was just heartbroken. But I think a lot of people don't, they're not believers. If you're not a believer, you're going to stay in a very linear, calcified, very, very vertical sort of a very constricted reality that's going to limit dramatically your growth and success, particularly today.
So what's the one question that people should ask themselves to be able to start breaking out of that narrow shell that you're talking about?
Well, I'm going to tell you what it is, but it presupposes the ability to really do a little assessment. What is my biggest underperforming opportunity or revenue activity or what relationships or resources am I not really monetizing properly? If you ask variants of that, you get all kind. If you have context of what's possible, you get all kinds of explosive answers.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate your time today, Jay. Now, you are actually going to be running a seminar next week in Australia. We'll put the links in below, the 27th of January. People can come along to that. It's free. And hear a bit more about your philosophies.
Yeah, I'm doing a high-level session, and it'll be pretty interesting. I think it'll help. And I hope that I'm not too abstract for your audience. This is very powerful, foundational, I want to say understanding. It's just, and the thing that I'd like to just leave you with is that most people, when it comes to business growth, they tend to think that it's more art than science. In truth, it's the opposite. You know, you can be better at it. I might have a better wired mind or ability to slice and dice, but it's more science. It's very predictable. It's a combination of geometry, of physics. It's very, 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 very understandable. And when people understand that if anybody can do math, they can make this work. And that's where it gets very demystifying and exciting if you can get into it. But I hope this has stimulated your viewers, your listeners, and maybe they'll challenge themselves a little higher.
Well, I'm sure they will. And the point to take away is it is achievable. It is something that can be done. It isn't sort of a magic sauce that nobody else can do, right? But there are a series of logical steps, logical questions, but you have to be able to have an open enough mind to start breaking down some of the barriers to be successful.
Yes, that's well stated. Thank you. I'm going to take you with me on my travels. You can be my torque converter, my translator.
Jay, thank you very much for your time today. I really have enjoyed talking with you and appreciate your time. And I'll put the links for the seminar below. Thank you very much.
The privilege of sharing. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.